Morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
James Harris for appellant, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The most important ruling in this case on appeal is the district court's ruling that Metropolitan's burden respecting actual knowledge required it, as part of its rebuttal burden, to rebut PBCC's theory that PBCC's UCC filings were in the
mouth. So you're going to use Metropolitan for Huntington?
Yes.
All right.
Is that all right?
Yes.
Do you care which I use?
Okay. No, that's fine.
That Metropolitan's burden required it to disprove PBCC's theory that that its UCC filings were in the Mountain Bank files. There are three independent legal errors that require reversal with respect to that conclusion. The first is, if you go back to the original trial, everybody knew the state of discovery, everybody knew the state of the evidence, and PBCC didn't even put forth this theory at trial. At trial, all that it argued was that the actual knowledge of Metropolitan's predecessor should be attributed to Metropolitan, and that satisfied the actual knowledge standard, disproved the actual knowledge standard under 9308. Because the theory was never even raised by PBCC at trial, the burden as a matter of law couldn't have shifted under, you know, conventional burden shifting analysis under the California Evidence Code. It couldn't have conceivably shifted to Metropolitan to disprove a theory that had never even been put on the table. That's the first legal error that the judge made.
Well, it seems to me, though, that the three-judge panel that sent this back,
yes,
even though it's not published, it would seem to me that it's law of the case that Metropolitan had the burden of proof on its defense under UCC 9-308A. It seems to me that that's what that three-judge panel said. Then if that is law of the case, and then the district judge assigned that burden to Metropolitan and found that Metropolitan did not meet its burden to establish lack of actual knowledge, it would seem, and then we review that for clearly erroneous, it would seem that if it's not clearly erroneous, then you lose.
Well, I'll assume we briefed the question of who has the burden of proof, and I won't repeat those arguments. But with respect to the question you're asking now, I'm making a more nuanced point. I'm assuming now that Metropolitan had the burden of proof. What the district court said, the district court didn't seem to doubt, if you read the district court's opinion carefully, he didn't doubt that Metropolitan established lack of knowledge in the first instance. What the district court said was PBCC put in evidence that its UCC filings were in the Mountain Bank files, and that Metropolitan therefore had to demonstrate that it didn't review those files in order to rebut the theory that PBCC tendered. My point is PBCC never tendered that theory at trial. The only argument it ever made at trial respecting actual knowledge and the due diligence period was that the knowledge of Metropolitan's predecessor should be attributed to it as a matter of law. That was the error that required the first reversal.
And then we said on appeal that was wrong, and we sent it back. I think the exact words were that Metropolitan needed to prove that without its actual knowledge of PBC's security interest, that burden was on you.
Yes, I understand.
So the theory that the case was originally tried on, and whatever position they took, was wrong, and you prevailed essentially, and you got it sent back. For the judge to determine whether you had met your burden.
But as a matter of law, since there was no new evidence submitted, we were playing with the same hand we were playing with at trial. And my point is that since PBCC, and I'll move on.
But you're playing with the same. What you're saying is based on the evidence at trial, in effect, the judge, if he complied with the mandate, had to determine whether you met your burden of proof.
Yes.
there seems to be a little bit the elephant in the room here. And, you know, obviously when you look at a cold record, you know, those of us that have been trial judges know it can look different when you're actually hearing it.
Yes.
And there was something that went on in trial to the effect of that I believe
PBCC.
PBBC.
It's hard to say.
Yeah, that they tried to get Metropolitan to admit when they had actual knowledge. And Metropolitan sort of fudged on that but said, okay, we did have actual knowledge at some point. And then so they admitted that, but then they wouldn't say exactly when they did. And if so, the courts does have an admission that they had actual knowledge at some point, and so then looking at everything else had to decide if they had actual knowledge at a time that would be appropriate.
Yes.
In this. And I don't see why, based on some credibility calls there that and certain things that the way the transactions had occurred, that the evidence wouldn't support that there was actual knowledge at an appropriate time.
Well, let's separate this into two pieces. There are a couple of appropriate times. The initial portfolio of loans was taken in May of 1998, and the judge said that Metropolitan didn't meet its burden of proof of not showing actual knowledge from the due diligence. And then there were substitution loans taken over the next couple of years, and that conceptually is a different issue. But I want to focus on the actual knowledge before the initial portfolio was taken, because if that finding falls, then basically the rest of the case for PBCC falls. With respect to actual knowledge, then, Metropolitan put in evidence that PBCC never took possession of the vast bulk of the chattel paper, and it never stamped the chattel paper. And we included in our brief the official comments from former Section 9308, which make clear that the purpose of 9308 is to encourage a robust secondary market in chattel paper, and that the secondary market can only work given that these transactions happen everywhere across the country. Every time a car dealer sells a car, it creates chattel paper and typically sells it. And so,
Counsel, I'm sorry to interject, but just a real quick question.
Yes.
Let's assume that you did see the UCC filing at the time the transaction closed. I agree with you that the language of the comment seems pretty clear that even though you have this blanket security interest in all chattel paper, somehow it suggests that you need to have specific knowledge of the individual chattel paper that's at issue. But
yes.
Are there circumstances where somebody could take a blanket security interest in all of a debtor's chattel paper, and then there would still be some individual piece of chattel paper that wouldn't be covered by that?
Not some circumstance. That's exactly what the comments go to. I mean, if you were to take a
Well, wait. You don't dispute that Pacific had a security interest in the chattel paper that your client.
No, we don't dispute that they had an initial security interest. We say that it was primed by virtue of 9308.
Right. But so I'm just trying to figure out, is there, because when I read, you know, to me the word all sort of suggests that if you know that somebody has a security interest in all of the debtor's chattel paper, that's going to cover everything. And I don't understand, are there circumstances where there would still be something left outside of all?
But the comments basically say it doesn't cover anything.
And I know, but why? I don't understand.
But that's what I am trying to explain.
Okay.
Chattel paper transactions occur around the country every single day. Every single car dealer creates a piece of chattel paper. When you buy a car, you get the title and you get a contract. Your contract is the chattel paper. Most every single dealer around the country sells that chattel paper. It's called factoring the receivables. They sell the chattel paper. These are small transactions. There are thousands of them every single day. So 9308 works the opposite of the way the rest of the UCC works. We all learned in law school that normally, if there's a security filing, that puts the whole world on notice, and you're basically doomed if that filing is on notice, is on file. 9308 works the opposite because the transactions are so small and they are so universal, there's so many thousands of them, that imposing the transaction cost on all these financiers who are going to buy the chattel paper would be enormous if they had to do a title search with respect to each and every piece of chattel paper they were buying.
Okay, I follow that. But if you know, you have actual knowledge that somebody's got a security interest in all of the chattel paper, what more do you need to know about a specific piece?
Well, here's the thing. If you take a look at the UCC filing here, it says, PBC has a security interest in every single piece of chattel paper that it now owns or may hereafter acquire.
Right.
Or hereafter acquire.
Right.
Frequently, as a practical matter, and this is borne out by the facts of this case, financiers like PBCC are grossly oversecured, and they don't bother taking security interests in each and every single one of the pieces of paper. The blanket filings end up being an inaccurate roadmap. They don't tell you what the financier has actually done. Many circumstances, specific pieces of chattel paper are not, in fact, within the security interest, have not, in fact, been pledged to the financier. And so the framers, the commentators to 9308, didn't want to put that burden of searching on the purchaser. And the comments are very, very clear. If you have knowledge of a blanket security interest that doesn't put you on knowledge of an interest in specific chattel paper, and it doesn't give you a duty of inquiry.
Okay. So is there – let's say that I'm the creditor and I take the blanket security interest in somebody's chattel paper. Is there something after that UCC filing that I have to do to perfect it as to an individual piece of chattel paper?
You perfect by virtue of – there are two ways to perfect. You can perfect by a filing, which is this, which is the disfavored method under 9308, or you can file, you can perfect by marking the chattel paper with your stamp, or by taking possession of it. And we gave you all sorts of authorities that say the law encourages the party in PBCC's position to stamp or take possession, and when they don't, the equities favor the innocent purchaser.
I follow that, but I'm just trying to get clarification on a more a narrower point. Okay. You said that there are circumstances where somebody takes a blanket security interest, but nonetheless, they don't actually get a security interest in all of
them. Yeah, right.
So what more do you have to do besides file one of these UCC files?
Well, something might not be pledged to you. But the most important...
Okay, but those are saying they might not, this, that, and the other. But when you have the burden of proving you did not have actual knowledge, how did you... You know, that particular statement of all seems to bode against you, and you have the you've got the burden to prove you did not have actual knowledge. Why was the district court wrong?
Well, the district court was wrong. It based on the commentary. The commentary says if the financier has not taken actual possession or hadn't stamped its lien on the paper, actual knowledge is unlikely to be present.
Okay,
as a practical matter, that creates a rebuttal.
But some of these are, you had the burden, and some of these are factual determinations. Metropolitan admitted it gained knowledge of PBCC's security interest at some point in time, quote unquote.
Right.
And it's incumbent on Metropolitan to show when it happened. There's nothing in the record to prove definitively that Metropolitan did gain knowledge of PBC's interest during the due diligence, but that Metropolitan had extensive contact with and access to records of Galaxy, Mountain, and First Commercial during that process, and one Metropolitan employee even admitted to having a conversation, albeit brief, with a Galaxy employee about PBC as a creditor. So I'm saying, given you had the burden, given that that's in the evidence, how's the district court, you know, it seems all to suggest that Metropolitan could have gained knowledge as early as the 1998 due diligence, and given that you had the burden to of proving,
well,
I don't see how the district court clearly erred.
The district court did not. The district court erred in several respects. First of all, the district court didn't cite any of the evidence that Metropolitan had introduced. Metropolitan introduced evidence from both the people who did the due diligence, and they said all we looked at were the loan files of the Galaxy customers. That's the loan file that Galaxy, when it's selling the mobile home, creates, where it looks at the credit ratings of the customer, looks at their employment, things like that. Both Mr. Taylor and Mr. Tyler said all we looked at were those credit files, and they said, and this is a quote, the credit files had purchase agreements, promissory notes, credit applications, credit reports, and payment records. So Taylor and Tyler both said that, and they also both said that they didn't look at any of the files respecting Mountain Bank's purchase of the chattel paper from Galaxy.
But what if the district – what if the district court didn't believe everything those witnesses said?
Well, there was no suggestion at any point. There was no impeachment. There was no argument by PVCC that that evidence was unworthy of belief. And the evidence came not only from Mr. Taylor, it came from Mr. Tyler, and it came from Mr. Taylor's boss, that in a transaction like this, all you care about are the underlying loan files. You don't care about the transaction between Galaxy and Mountain Bank.
Do you want to save your time for rebuttal?
Yes, please.
Can I
go ahead. Ask a question.
One of the things that I want to get clear in my mind, there was a time in 1999 that you got information from Discovery.
Yes.
And as I understand it, it said it told you that PVCC had a security interest in all the loan contracts now owned or hereafter acquired by Galaxy.
Yes.
So I have two questions. First, I just want to be sure that goes beyond the UCC filing in terms of the information it gave you, at least it seems to me. And number two, if you knew, if that was sufficient to show that you knew in October of 1999, mm-hmm. that is relevant because, and finish the sentence for me.
That would be relevant only as to the substitution contracts that were taken after that date. It would have no relevance with respect to the initial portfolio or the prior substitution.
So if let's assume hypothetically, if we agreed with you on the earlier one, but we disagreed with you and we said you had knowledge as of October 1st, 1999, and that would at least, affect the issue of damages?
It would affect it dramatically because about two-thirds of the loans would have been taken prior to that date. And the other point that I would make in connection with your observation about the pledge agreements is that they only identified specific pieces of chattel paper, only a handful, most of which had actually been released by Mountain Bank. So at most, what those pledge agreements would put Metropolitan notice as to would be the specific pieces of chattel paper identified in the exhibits to those agreements. And I'll come back and rebuttal and explain why.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Kim DeMarchi, and I represent Pacific Business Capital Corporation in this matter. What's important to understand in this case is that Metro Bank, in order to avoid a judgment against it for conversion, had to prove all three elements of a defense under UCC Section 9308. And it failed on all three as to the substitute contracts, and on two of the three as to the initial contracts as well. And the district court made factual findings on each of those factors, and this court's task is really to evaluate whether the district court clearly erred in making those
maybe you can
findings.
Just start with the
I'll start with whichever one the court would like.
Well, the one that I was asking counsel about, I read those comments to, is it 9308, as being pretty strongly in their favor. So just tell me, why is his reading of those comments wrong?
Because his reading carefully avoids what the comments talk about. The comments say mere knowledge that there is some blanket security interest doesn't mean
in chattel paper. Okay.
Mere knowledge that there's some interest in chattel paper, a blanket interest, doesn't tell you what that blanket covers. That comment is really directed at the kind of UCC filing that says PVCC has a security interest in chattel paper and stops there. Doesn't say which chattel paper. Doesn't either say these five pieces or all. That commentary isn't directed toward UCC filing statements that are more precise. And using the word all is a way to be more precise. And in fact, it's the only way to be more precise that's available to the holder of a security interest like PVCC that holds not just a security interest in currently existing chattel paper, but also in chattel paper that's continuing to be generated. The business at issue here is a seller of mobile homes. and they're selling homes off the lot every day and creating pieces of chattel paper. And the nature of the agreement is not what Mr. Harris just suggested to you. The pledge agreement doesn't say we only have a security interest in these listed contracts. It says we have a security interest in every single piece of chattel paper, including the things that are listed. So there's no other way to have a specific UCC filing, and the comments don't suggest that there is. The comments are really directed at a practice of UCC filings that are really too vague to permit people to understand exactly which pieces of chattel paper or other kinds of collateral it applies to. And when you've got a vague UCC statement, what that commentary is saying is you can't just say any kind of UCC statement that might touch this collateral is enough to put you on notice so that you have to inquire. That would be a reason to know standard. That's really what the commentary is directed at clarifying that you have to have some piece of information that ties the security interest to these particular pieces of chattel paper. And as Your Honor noted in his questioning, all actually does mean all. And a reasonable reader of that should understand that it's every single piece of chattel paper. This isn't a one-sentence UCC. It's a UCC statement that not only says all chattel paper, but then has a one-page typewritten list of what all the inventory is.
What's a little bit tricky here is that placing the burden on Metropolitan seems to require it to prove a negative, specifically to prove it didn't have actual knowledge. So what would Metropolitan have needed to show to satisfy that requirement?
Well, and there, the district court's specific discussion of the evidence is particularly helpful. Like most defendants in civil litigation, Metropolitan didn't put up a witness who confessed to knowing about the security interest. They put up a couple of witnesses who didn't even work at the company at the time of the transaction. They put up their chief credit officer who wasn't personally involved in due diligence.
Well, it seems that they did introduce testimony that seemed to establish that employees had not seen the UCC one or the UCC three filings. And so wasn't that enough for Metropolitan to show it lacked actual knowledge?
And the district court found that it wasn't, and that's because the district court weighed that evidence with all the evidence. It's important to understand that Mr. Taylor did not actually deny seeing the UCC one or the UCC three, specifically releasing only part of that interest in every single piece of chattel paper, nor did he deny seeing the pledge agreements or security agreements or the letter from PBCC to Metro Bank reiterating that it continued to have a security, to Mountain Community Bank, reiterating that it continued to have a security interest. He just said he couldn't remember. And he also testified, and the district court specifically relied on this, he testified that he had a file of notes that he'd created during the due diligence process, but that was never provided, was never introduced into evidence. The district court found it relevant that if Mr. Taylor, and excuse me, there's a Taylor and a Tyler, if Mr. Taylor actually hadn't looked at the records, actually didn't know about this, that that additional evidence of exactly what was included in his due diligence would have been important.
Well, I guess this goes to what I was talking about. When we look at a cold record as opposed to when you actually see witnesses and you have a sense of what's going on, in looking at the cold record, what are we missing here that in terms of the district court was saying, okay, yeah, you say that, but I don't believe that? Or so what's going on there from your perspective that assists you in asking for an affirmance of the district court saying, hey, you didn't meet your burden?
The other part of what's going on there is Metro's admission that it had knowledge at some point. And it's particularly interesting that Metro gets a request for admission. The rules require a party who receives a request for admission to specifically deny what they're asked to admit. And if they don't specifically deny something, the rule itself says that's deemed admitted. And what Metro Bank says in response to a request that they admit they knew on April 15, 1998 is, we knew at some point, we're not sure when we knew, but we'll get back to you. And they never respond. Now, under the rules, that alone constitutes an admission as of April 15th.
Well, didn't you have an obligation to follow up and press them for an answer?
No. The rule itself says whatever you don't specifically admit is denied. There are instances where admissions are a discovery sanction, but those involve a different kind of noncompliance with requests for admission.
To get the admission that you're talking about, you would have had to bring a motion to compel to get them to respond, no?
No, that's actually under subsection A of the rule. Admissions, you can, what the court can do is say, someone who just doesn't respond or responds only partially or responds ambiguously so you can't tell what they denied, they can be deemed to admit because they essentially monkeyed around in answering. And that's subsection A.
If you bring a motion.
But subsection B says the effect of failing to specifically deny is to admit. That's a self-executing section of the rule. The district court, the other thing that's important to recognize is that the district court considered that discovery response. The district court didn't take the position I'm taking, didn't say I'm just going to deem this admitted. The district court said I'm going to look at the fact that even when you were responding to a request for admission, you couldn't pin down the date. And then I'm going to look at all the testimony you've given me and all of the information that they've produced in the record, all of which was in the original trial. It wasn't the basis for the district court's first decision, but it was in the original trial. Both parties had the opportunity to ask to supplement evidence. We didn't have any obligation to do so because we already had enough evidence from which the district court could rule in our favor.
So you're saying the district court made a negative inference by the fact that after even putting all of that on, they never pinpointed when they had actual knowledge. They admitted they had actual knowledge at some point, but they never – so the district court sort of – that was a problem.
That was a problem for the district court. The district court identified that as part of the problem and coupled that with the testimony of Mr. Taylor, who was really the only person with personal knowledge of what happened during his review and his inability to make an express denial that he had seen this information. All he would say was that he couldn't recall and he hadn't produced any of his notes of the time that would have let you know what he looked at or what he didn't look at. The only other person involved in that review was Mr. Tyler. He's First Commercial Bank's representative, and what he essentially said was, I'm not the one who looked at the Galaxy documents. Mr. Taylor looked at the Galaxy documents. So Mr. Taylor's the only one who can testify, and the district court found on the totality of the evidence that Metro Bank hadn't quite reached its 50% plus one to meet its burden of proof. And that is really a decision for the district court. If that's a reasonable reading of the evidence, it has to be affirmed on appeal.
One of the points I think that you made in your brief is that Metropolitan never produced its due diligence file. Was there a request for production of it and they never produced it? Or does the record simply indicate there was a due diligence file but they never produced it?
The record indicates that there was a due diligence file. It's the district court that relied on the absence of that documentation, coupled with the fact that the person whose notes those were said, I can't remember. That was the district court in weighing the evidence, essentially saying, if you can't remember and you admit there were paper documents, I would have expected to see paper documents that would have helped me believe that you are telling the truth when you say, we didn't know.
Well, it's sort of like when you say that, you know, so-and-so saw this happen, and then you don't call so-and-so as a witness, that the trier of fact is allowed to make a negative inference by the fact that you don't call that witness who would have been a logical witness to support your viewpoint. Is that what you're arguing?
Exactly. And that's really the overall problem Metro Bank had on its burden of proof on knowledge. It couldn't quite get anybody who could really establish that no one knew about this security interest in April of 1998 when Metro Bank was doing
its due
diligence.
Well, they make an argument which goes like this. If they had actual knowledge, why would they have made a multi-million dollar purchase without, in the face of that knowledge? It has some plausibility, and they say on page 5 of their reply brief, that you, in effect, made a strategic decision to argue on the basis of that they should have known in order to avoid having to answer the question, is if they actually had knowledge, why would they have gone ahead with this transaction?
And the answer, well, there are a couple of answers to that question. One is because they thought they could get away with it. The record demonstrates that what they did after they obtained these records was went to the Nevada Division of Manufactured Housing and registered their lien rights. in each of these individual mobile homes. That's how they hoped to document. They also hoped to introduce the negligence argument that you've heard some hint of here today and that's in the briefs, the idea that PVCC couldn't really have had a security interest in these documents because it didn't go through and stamp every mobile home contract as each mobile home was being sold by its debtor in another state.
So they made a strategic decision to go forward with knowledge and, you know, based on some possibility that they could get away with it? Does that sound how a reasonable person would act?
And that is a factual determination for the district court to make. It's also important to recognize that what the district court found was that there was sufficient evidence that Mr. Taylor, who's not the decision maker at Metro, he's a line employee who does due diligence. He's their agent for purposes of obtaining knowledge. But the district court focused on what he learned about, not on what the loan committee learned about. And so it's reasonable to believe that there were individuals involved in decision-making at Metro Bank that might not have known about the security interest, but that's not the test under 9308. Mr. Taylor's knowledge is attributable and is sufficient to defeat the defense under 9308. I only have about 7 minutes left.
Let me ask you about, well, like we said, it's our 7 minutes. The $17 million is pretty harsh. But that's not really being questioned here?
No, that was affirmed by the first panel. It's not before this court.
Okay. Now you can go and use your time.
Okay. It's important to understand that in addition to this knowledge finding, which precludes all of Metrobank's defenses on all loans, the district court also found a lack of evidence of possession. And 9308 doesn't just require lack of knowledge. It requires that the purchaser actually took possession of the chattel paper. The district court has pages and pages of examination of evidence, and I don't want to go through all of them. They're all in the record. But the key here is those factual findings themselves are an independent basis on which this court can and should affirm. Because even if Mr. Harris could establish that the district court was wrong on the knowledge factor, he'd also have to establish that the district court was wrong on the possession factor.
Well, except that if we – let's say we disagree with you about actual knowledge at the outset, okay, and we move to the 1999 time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some different argument that you've got as to the discovery that they got in 1999? Because as I understand it, if you lose on that, then basically actual knowledge doesn't come until after it doesn't matter anymore, right?
No. Let me try to answer that in a way that's as clear as possible. It's these three factors, and they move around each other in ways that are complicated. The standard requires that they take possession before obtaining knowledge. The district court found they didn't bear their burden of proof on possession, period, ever, as of any date.
Didn't possess
all the originals, and then there are a handful of loans that they possessed on various dates. But as to a substantial number of the loans, just never had any original. And then as to all loans, found that there was evidence that Galaxy regularly created multiple originals and that Metrobank would have had to possess multiple originals.
Put aside the duplicate originals, though. Okay, just put that aside.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the court made a finding that in February of 2001, they actually did have at least actual possession of all of the original contracts. Putting aside the duplicate.
No. The district court found that for many of the contracts, they didn't prove that they ever had any originals. That's found on pages 16 to 17 of the district court's opinion. And then as to others, pages 11 to 17 of that decision, there are a handful of contracts where there were specific possession dates. Those possession dates range from October of 1998 through August of 2000. And, of course, August of 2000 is well after the October 1st.
That's what I'm saying. But if
right.
You lose on that, so go back to October of 99. Why did they acquire actual knowledge then if they didn't at the outset of the transaction?
If they were able to convince this court that the district court committed clear error in finding that they hadn't met
their
burden of not knowing.
That's what I'm asking you, Sim. So just
right.
Get to 99.
There's no way to get around the fact that their lawyer, who is their agent for purposes of knowledge, received in litigation over Galaxy and the Galaxy debt and the Scrip interest.
What did they get that's different from what they got at the outset? Just tell me that.
They got the pledge agreements.
Okay. What does that give them in terms of actual knowledge that the that if they saw the UCC filing at the outset, wouldn't have given them?
The pledge agreement specifically states that PBCC has an interest in every single piece of chattel paper.
Okay. But that's what the UCC filings told them. No? Is there something different? That's all I'm asking. Well, is there something different that they got in 99 that they didn't get in 98 when they saw the UCC filings?
They got it written out in more paragraphs. They got it written out. If their argument is that the commentary to the UCC says that a UCC-1 filing alone, if it describes a big security interest, can't possibly give you knowledge of what's under that blanket, the pledge agreement that explains exactly what the security interest is surely must be able to give you knowledge of exactly what that security interest is.
But the comment doesn't apply to that.
Comment doesn't apply to the actual agreements evidencing the security interests, and it doesn't try to. The comment is only directed at UCC-1s, and it's only directed at UCC-1s that are insufficiently specific to let you know exactly which kinds or pieces of collateral are covered.
Could I be sure I understand your answer to Judge Watford? I understand that in 1999 they got in discovery pledge agreements that states that Galaxy grants to PBCC a security interest in all of the loan contracts now owned or hereafter required by Galaxy.
That's right, and those are the pieces of chattel paper.
Was that more? I thought Judge Watford was asking you whether that was more or less than the filing that we were talking about under the UCC.
It's exactly the same security interest.
No, but the information says it grants a security interest in all of the loan contracts now owned or hereafter acquired. Was that in the UCC filings? Is that the exact language in the UCC filings?
The exact language in the UCC filings is all chattel paper. The pledge agreement talks about all loan contracts.
Well, but isn't that different? That is much more specific.
It's sort of a Venn diagram. Loan contracts are a form of chattel paper. They're not the only chattel paper, but all does mean all. And there's no dispute that these items were chattel paper or that they were chattel paper of Galaxy and Silver State, nor can there be any reasonable disagreement that all means all. Metro Bank's argument is really seizing on a comment in the UCC that's directed at much more ambiguous UCC filings than this. In my last 30 seconds, I do just want to say that as to the replacement contracts, regardless of the evidence on knowledge, regardless of the evidence on possession, there's no evidence of new value because the only reason that Metro Bank ever gets a replacement contract is that the terms of its deal say, you're not really buying these contracts, you're buying a rate of return. And if one of them turns out to be a bad contract, you can switch it out for a good contract, so you're really still getting your rate of return. That's not new value in the sense of 9308, because the new value requirement of 9308 is intended to protect the entirely innocent first security interest holder, like PBCC, from the devaluation of their collateral. And new value does that because as you take the one thing out, you put new money in, so my client remains protected. That's a very important part of the 9308 test, and of course it's not satisfied by the substitution of defaulting deficient loan contracts for ones that are actually paying out.
Could I ask you one last question about this that I'm having trouble following? This issue of the duplicate originals and the fact that Metro didn't obtain the duplicate originals. I'm trying to understand what's the significance of that? How did that prejudice you? In other words, okay, there were duplicate originals. They say of the 160, only three duplicate originals were sold to somebody else. How does the fact that they didn't get duplicate originals, the existence of which they were unaware of, how does that, I'm just trying to figure out how that should defeat, as the district court seemed to suggest, their ability to succeed?
It's important to understand the evidence is not that there are just three duplicate originals. It's that duplicate originals were routinely created. In fact,
okay. But what they're arguing in their reply brief, if it's correct, you could say that the facts are wrong. But they said that this report of a receiver said that although there may have been X number of duplicates created, that of the ones at issue here, only three were actually sold to somebody else.
12 of them were in the possession of my client and were introduced as exhibits at the trial. But the legal relevance of duplicate originals is this. Section 9308 is intended to facilitate the market in chattel paper. But that doesn't mean that the first-in-time secured creditor doesn't have any way to protect their interests. And the requirement of possession in 9308, the reason that it's one of those three elements, is that actually obtaining all of the originals is a way for a responsible, truly innocent, second-in-time security interest party, secured party, to actually make sure that the person they're buying that interest from has the ability to sell that interest to them. And the ability to show up with all of the originals and the physical passage of those originals from one person to another is what the UCC has identified as an important factor in establishing the legitimacy and innocence of that transaction. So it's not a matter of prejudice. It's a matter of it's a requirement under the rule.
So that I just want to be sure if I understand you. Is this just simply go to the issue of whether they had knowledge or not?
It goes to the issue of possession. They had to possess the originals, and if there were multiple originals, as Galaxy's employee testified was a regular transaction, a regular occurrence, they had to possess all the originals. And that happens a lot when you sign two versions of a contract because there are two parties and everyone wants an original.
Well, but this is, I'm just confused. Let's assume they had to possess all the originals, but what I thought the district court was saying is that they also had to possess all the duplicates. Or is that wrong? Did the district court not say that?
The district court said they had to possess all the originals, and the UCC recognizes that it's possible for more than one thing to be the original of the same piece of chattel paper. It makes my head hurt, too. But that's a UCC thing. In commerce, we actually sometimes have two originals of the same thing.
But you weren't prejudiced by this. I mean, this essentially, if I just want to be sure I understand, it goes ultimately to the issue of knowledge. I don't see how are they supposed to get be faulted for not having copies of originals that they weren't even aware of.
They're not copies. They're originals. And the way in which it prejudices the first-in-time security interest holder under the UCC is that one of the ways that person holding a security interest can protect themselves is by demanding that they've received the originals. That's why you require that all of the originals go with the person who's getting the primary security interest. And what the district court found here was that in addition to there not being evidence that they ever possessed any originals of certain contracts, as well as knowledge and new value, that there were duplicate originals and they didn't get all of them. And the case law is quite clear that they have to get all of the originals to satisfy the UCC's possession requirement.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With respect to actual knowledge, I briefly like to make three points conceptually. First, this is not a he said, she said case. The district judge said Metropolitan affirmatively had to put in evidence that they didn't see the UCCs during due diligence. Metropolitan had no reason to do that because that issue had never been tendered. Why do you have to respond to an issue that's never been?
She raised the point about, I can see where a trial judge would become quite suspicious of someone when they say they did due diligence, but then they don't see the reports. When they say they don't remember something, but they do have notes, but they purposely don't provide the notes.
Okay, well, that segues into my second point. Mr. Taylor said that all he looked at were the underlying customer files. He looked at payment records, job job credit applications, things like that. That's what he took notes on. He was very clear about that. He was very clear that he didn't look at the transaction files between Galaxy and Mountain Bank, which is where the UCC might have been. So the district judge just ignored all that.
But your argument would be better if you didn't have the burden of proof stating those points. But if you have the burden of proof, then I think then what your, you know, counsel on the other side would argue is, you know, if you had the burden of proof, then, you know, put it all out there. You said you knew it. You had an actual knowledge at some point, but you never proved that.
Well, we proved that we didn't have it during the due diligence by virtue of what Mr. Taylor and Tyler said. They said what they looked at and what they looked at. And all the, by the way, all the customer loan files were put in evidence at trial, and none of them contained the UCCs. So it's absolutely clear that
What about the due diligence file?
The due diligence file? Well, he left the company. He evidently had some notes, and he has no idea what happened to him. I don't think they were ever specifically requested.
First of all, you never, to get back to what you started with, you never asked the judge, given the remand from the Ninth Circuit, you never asked to put in any more evidence.
No, both parties stipulated it would go on the same record.
Did you ask the judge to make a specific finding of fact as to whether or not he believed or disbelieved your witnesses?
The judge did not make a finding of fact. The judge made a conclusion of law that we could meet our burden of proof only if Mr. Taylor had said, I looked in those files and didn't see any UCCs. But three points. One, that theory had never been tendered. Two, Mr. Taylor said, I looked only in the loan files and what I saw in loan files, and then he listed a bunch of things that didn't include the UCCs. And then third, the UCCs as a matter of law would not have imparted knowledge. And that comes from the specific language of 9308, which talks about knowledge in specific chattel paper. And all the commentaries that I discussed on my initial argument are based on the specific language and the specific policies of 9308. And I think where the trial judge went astray is he didn't really believe that 9308 operates contrary to the way the rest of the UCC operates, and that the party in PBC's position is disfavored because they didn't stamp or take possession.
Well, if he didn't believe that, why did he need to go to the alternate theories? He had alternate theories of why you were going to lose.
Alternate theories that are so far beyond the remand, it's almost mind-boggling. I mean, the purchase loan theory that he relied on was never even briefed on remand. And it had been argued and lost before him in the original trial and argued and lost on appeal. I mean, frankly, this is a judge who concluded for whatever reason that our party wore the black hat, the other party wore the white hat, and what we don't have rational fact-finding here. What we have is a judge trying to appeal proof by going outside the remand. With respect to duplicate contracts, these were fraudulent contracts that my client had no knowledge of. There's never been a case in the history of the UCC that says to prove possession, you have to prove that nobody created any fraudulent contracts. It would be a mind-boggling new rule that would really upend the entire secondary market in chattel paper.
Can you just address real quickly her argument on new value?
A new value. I think a new value. The Linwood case is dispositive, as is the statutory language. The statutory language says if you release a security interest, that's new value. And that's exactly what happened. Every time a substitute was returned, a security interest was released, and Galaxy got the right to either try to collect the payments under that security interest or repossess. So there was new value as a matter of law.
I mean, you're exchanging something that it seems, in my eyes at least, to be almost worthless. It's a defaulted loan.
This is a defaulted contract, yes.
Or a performing loan. That just doesn't seem like it's anywhere close to being an equivalent exchange.
It doesn't have to be an equivalent exchange. All it has to be is an exchange. I mean, this goes back to first-year contracts and the nature of consideration. It doesn't have to be
equivalent. So even if it's a sham exchange, that's okay?
No, this is not a sham exchange. There was value there because they had the right to repossess the mobile homes. That's not sham consideration.
But you're depleting the debtor's estate. I mean, that, to me, the new value requirement seems like, oh, okay, you're going to give up something, but the debtor, you know, you're there's some at least rough equivalence, right? But in this situation, you're just completely depleting the debtor's estate.
Well, you're not completely it's not an equivalent transaction, that's for sure. But it is new value, and it's new value under the definition of new value, the release of a security interest. The Linwood case is dispositive. I think on the first appeal, the first panel basically told the district judge that it thought the Linwood case demonstrated new value. It was either a soft reversal or a strong hint, and the district judge didn't take the hint. But also the original purchase price constituted new value. If, for example,
right, you need to wrap up your.
Can I make this one last point?
Well, you can make. You have 1 minute.
Thank you.
Already 4 minutes over.
If you were to buy a piece of stereo equipment and it didn't work and you took it back, you wouldn't be thinking that you got and you got a replacement. You wouldn't be thinking you got the second one for free. What you'd be thinking is the original purchase price entitled you to a working stereo. And so the original purchase price, as a matter of law, constituted new value. And unless there are any further questions, I thank the Court for its indulgence.
All right. Thank you both for your argument. This is a difficult case, and you both did a good job on argument. We appreciate that. This matter will stand submitted.
Thank you.